This Hour's Top Stories. A new poll in the U.S. shows about 1 in 4 Americans are still struggling financially a year after the start of the coronavirus pandemic. Jury selection begins for the trial of a former U.S. white police officer charged with the killing of George Floyd, an unarmed black man. Tensions between the UK and the European Union escalate as the two sides criticize each other over COVID-19 vaccine exports. Welcome to the program. A newly conducted poll in the U.S. shows over 4 in 10 Americans are still grappling with the financial impact of the coronavirus pandemic. A survey conducted by the Associated Press suggests 1 in 4 U.S. citizens have experienced household layoffs during the pandemic. It also shows COVID-19 has affected poorer communities and people of color more adversely. The outbreak has also impacted service, entertainment, and travel sectors worse than the others. The United States is the worst hit country in the world by the coronavirus. It has recorded more than 29 million infection cases and over 527,000 fatalities. To discuss this a little bit further, I'm going to bring in Professor David Barkin. He's the professor of economics with Metropolitan Autonomous University, who joins us via Skype out of Mexico City. I just read some figures and numbers, but how bad would you describe the situation?
I would describe the situation as terrible. More than 500,000 people have been died. Almost 10% of the United States population has been infected by the official figures. The figures you talked about in terms of layoffs, the terms of the discrimination against people of color, Latins, other minority groups, only begins to touch the surface of the depths of the inequality of the, I'm sorry, the unequal impact of the virus, the pandemic, on the American people. What's the most extraordinary thing about it is the hope that the way in which the new legislation that Biden has now pushed, I think almost pushed through the Congress, will try to reverse this dynamic. And I'm not sure of that, because the impetus of the new program is to depend upon the market through greater spending, through greater financial, small amount of financial aid to families will stimulate the economy. But I think that the real problem is that there are structural issues that are involved. Millions of people are being threatened with eviction from their homes because they can't pay the rent, in spite of federal guidelines that were supposed to postpone this. The problem of people being unable to pay their mortgages, the profound problem of the inability of many Americans, especially those hardest hit, to obtain an adequate diet because of what are called food deserts, exactly in these communities of people of color and minority groups, is just extraordinary. So I think that the kind of description you read at the beginning of your program is just an introduction to the long-lasting effects that the pandemic will have on U.S. society.
Sure. Professor, looking at the situation, who will the Americans, or do the Americans, point the finger of blame towards for the the dire situation that you also described that they are suffering today?
I think that there's a very generalized agreement that the bad handling, the terrible, inadequate handling of the pandemic a year ago, just this month, is the starting point of many of the problems. But then that was aggravated by the fact that the upper echelons of the previous administration were in denial about the seriousness of the pandemic. And then on top of that, you had a massive tax cut which increased the ability of the rich people to avoid paying taxes and increased inequality, but also heightened social tensions, which led to a flourishing, an extraordinary flourishing, of the kinds of civil strife and violence that have taken place, with a tremendous response from police and military forces all over the United States, which led to repression and an increasing abuse of military force, of military techniques by the police force to repress the discontent that was showing up all over the country. And if you add to that the environmental damages which have been accumulating over the past 5 years, you have a recipe for the kinds of problems which Biden has inherited, but doesn't seem really able to confront in a headfast way. He doesn't have the power in the Congress or even the support of his own party to really go ahead with an ambitious program to put the country back on its tracks.
Professor David Barking with Metropolitan Autonomous University out of Mexico City. It was a pleasure to speak to you, sir. Jury selection for the trial of the white police officer involved in the death of African-American George Floyd has begun in the U.S. city of Minneapolis. About 2,000 National Guards have been called to quell any possible unrest outside the court. The proceedings were scheduled to start on Monday, but were put off after a higher court asked the judge to consider bringing another charge against former officer Derek Chauvin. Video footage showed the officer kneeling on Floyd's neck for about 9 minutes while attempting to arrest him in May of last year. He is now facing second-degree murder and manslaughter charges. If convicted on the most serious charge, he can face a sentence of up to 40 years in prison. The death of Floyd sparked a flurry of protests against racial injustice and prompted calls for police reform in the U.S. Now, Britain summons the European Union's UK representative amid a deepening row over COVID-19 vaccine exports. This comes after European Council President Charles Michel claimed Britain and the U.S. have imposed a ban on the export of vaccines produced in their territory. In a letter to Michel, UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab argued that any references to a UK export ban or any restrictions on vaccines are completely false. The EU is criticized for a slow vaccine rollout, not doing enough to supply jabs to poor countries. But the bloc defended its overall strategy, saying without Europe, it would not have been possible to develop several vaccines in less than a year. Now, the chances of survival for those suffering severe illness due to COVID-19 differs greatly across the European Union. EU lawmakers say the pandemic has highlighted deadly health inequalities within the bloc. Jerome Hughes is in Brussels.
How the EU deals with crises was the subject of scathing criticism during a debate on the bloc's health systems in the European Parliament. There were major failings when COVID-19 began to wreak havoc in Italy 13 months ago, and now the EU's vaccine strategy is being described as a fiasco.
ci sta chiedendo perché.
Citizens are wondering why we are not rolling out the Chinese, Russian or Cuban vaccines. Perhaps it's because the European Union has decided to give more importance to relations with the US instead of saving thousands of people.
The death toll from COVID-19 in the 27-country EU is approaching 550,000.
The pandemic exposed the vulnerability of our healthcare systems as we experienced care disruptions, medical shortages, health system inadequacy, insufficient and unequal access to healthcare.
Instead of improving during the course of the pandemic, apparently the situation is getting worse.
Some of these inequalities are widening, not only across countries, but also across population groups within each country.
One clear example of inequality was highlighted during the debate. Statistics show a person in intensive care with COVID-19 in Luxembourg has a 65% chance of survival. In fellow EU nation Romania, it's just 25%. Some legislators say the EU's poor handling of successive crises has dangerous political consequences, and experts agree.
We're seeing the rise of the far right across Europe, and this is not just far right, not right, just right-wing populism. This is naked racism. This is neo-fascism.
The EU Commissioner for Health, Stella Kariakides, has told lawmakers that lessons have been learned the hard way due to the coronavirus.
Indeed, we're determined to respond in a way that looks to the future, develops concrete benefits and protection to the citizens.
Legislators have just passed a 5.1 billion euro budget for a programme called EU for Health. However, they are well aware that reforms don't happen overnight when it comes to the EU project. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Hundreds of health facilities across Yemen are on the brink of collapse due to the Saudi blockade and lack of fuel. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion has warned that it can no longer store blood stocks. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has more.
Thousands of cancer patients in Yemen are in dire need of help. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion and Research says the blood stocks and components of concentrated red cells, fresh frozen plasma and the platelets cannot be reserved anymore due to the lack of fuel.
We have entered the dangerous stage of the collapse of health centers across the country. Our branches in Hodeidah and LBB have stopped their operations and the rest of the branches are about to stop. There is no justification for this blockade. The interruptions in the import of fuel mean the death of patients with kidney failure and chronic diseases.
The center provides services to hundreds of kidney failure patients and cancer patients, including children with leukemia, who depend on the center to obtain the necessary substances to survive.
This center provides more than 60% of its services to people with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure, and wounded people. The fuel crisis is making an already bad situation worse amid the war and siege. Patients with kidney failure and leukemia need regular checks and doses of medicines, and stopping these services leads to the death of patients.
Yemenis are suffering from fuel shortage due to the continued detention of 14 petrol ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The fuel crisis is threatening the closure of over 1,500 health facilities around the country. International aid organizations and watchdogs have warned that the lives of millions of people in Yemen are in danger due to the all-out blockade imposed on the country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The international community has so far failed to take action and stop Riyadh from committing war crimes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The U.S. has blacklisted two members of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, accusing them of human rights violations. The U.S. State Department imposed sanctions on the IRGC officials and their immediate family members. Washington said the individuals were involved in violating the rights of people detained during street protests in Iran in 2019 and 2020. Tehran has repeatedly rejected such claims by U.S. officials as invalid and hypocritical. The Islamic Republic accuses the U.S. itself of breaching the human rights of Iranians with its sanctions. Iran says Washington's restrictions have adversely affected the well-being of the people of Iran and amounts to economic terrorism. Human rights activists Firas and Najim believes Washington's latest sanctions against Iranian individuals shows the U.S. is a hypocrite with no ethics.
This also just again clarifies and exposes the U.S. administration and their lack of ethics and morals and principles, because Biden, before he came into power, he said that he was going to reinstate the nuclear agreement. He's going to try to patch things up and try to build a relationship with Iran. But it's good that this is happening in an early stage before it gets to another stage where they get into negotiations and things like that, and then they throw out everything or they step on everything. The U.S. is not a trusted partner in any way. We've seen what happened with Obama when they did the nuclear agreement, and then what happened after that when Trump came in, and now we have the same thing flowing. At least, like I said, it's an early stage for us to reveal the issue and see how hypocritical that the U.S. administration is. I mean, their best allies are Israel and Saudi Arabia, and they're committing war crimes, not just human rights violations, as they claim in Iran.
The UN Human Rights Office has expressed dismay that Switzerland is set to outlaw facial covering worn by some Muslim women. The agency says the country, by approving the law, will join a few other states where actively discriminating against Muslim women is legal. A spokeswoman for the agency stated that the use of the law to dictate what women should wear will be problematic from a human rights perspective. She added that the ban will unduly restrict women's freedom to manifest their religion or beliefs. In a referendum on Sunday, Swiss voters narrowly approved the measure, which also banned ski masks and bandanas worn by some protesters. The approval mandates the authorities to draw up detailed legislation in the next 2 years. And now, UK's Queen Elizabeth II vows to address her grandson Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle's claims regarding racism within the monarchy. In a statement, the Queen said the whole family is saddened to learn the full extent of how challenging the last few years have been for Harry and Meghan. She added that the issues raised, in particular that of race, are concerning and will be addressed by the family privately. The statement comes amid the mounting pressure on Buckingham Palace to respond to the claims the couple made during a bombshell interview with a prominent U.S. news broadcaster on Sunday. Meghan claimed she faced racist comments and insults during or directly from the royal family. Political commentator Kenneth Farrow says racism in the royal family comes as no surprise, as discrimination has been ongoing in the UK for hundreds of years.
Well, I think that response is completely and utterly inadequate. This is no surprise that there's racism within the royal family. We've seen it come up again and again, not just in this particular monarchy, but in previous kings and queens of this country. And so the royal family simply reflects what's felt amongst the people. And the fact of the matter is that if you're black in the UK, you stand more chance of dying at the hands of the police. Your employment prospects are going to be very low. In terms of the health service, we've seen during COVID, black and Asian people are dying at a 3 times the rate of white people. Black and Asian nurses are dying on the front line. And so Britain currently, historically, in terms of colonialism and imperialism, has got a terrible and bloody history of racism. So it's no surprise that the royal family are subject to this this disease and this attitude, which has been going on in this country for hundreds of years. So really, the response of the Queen is completely irrelevant.
Diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
It is despicable and unacceptable that there is not unanimous support among Democrats in Congress for a $15 minimum wage, said Representative Jamal Bauman. The listeners stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stancil, author. This article is published under the heading, Shameful. Millionaire senators vote against popular minimum wage raise that would lift millions out of poverty. Here's more on that. After eight members of the Democratic caucus joined all 50 Republicans in the U.S. Senate recently to kill an amendment reattaching a $15 minimum wage provision to the Senate's coronavirus relief package, Progressive pointed out that nearly every single one of the lawmakers who voted against the raise for low-paid workers nationwide is a millionaire. Today's vote on Senator Sanders' $15 minimum wage amendment is incredibly sad. Maurice Pirrell, chair of the Patriotic Millionaires and author of the forthcoming book, Tax the Rich, said in a statement recently, "The $15 per hour is the bare minimum anyone in this country needs to survive," Pirrell continued. "And it is baffling that any member of the U.S. Senate, much less a number of Democrats, could look at the crisis this country is enduring and decide that tens of millions of low-income workers, including millions of frontline workers who put their lives on the line every day in the midst of a global pandemic, should not get a raise," he added. Nina Turner, co-chair of Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign and current candidate running for election to U.S. House in Ohio's 11th district, responded to the vote by tweeting, "Every single one of the senators who voted against raising the minimum wage is a millionaire." Journalist Ken Klippestein shared the net worth according to the most recent financial disclosures compiled by the Center for Responsive Politics of the eight Democrats who voted against Sanders' $15 minimum wage amendment. While her present net worth may trail that of other lawmakers, Senator Kyrsten Sinema was especially enthusiastic about denying a raise to millions of poorly paid U.S. workers. With her $174,000 annual salary, Sinema is well on her way to joining her wealthier colleagues in the millionaire ranks. In his statement, Pirrell said that the Senate failed the American people today. Every single Republican senator who voted against $15 today failed their constituents. Pirrell added, "The Democrats who voted against $15 today not only failed their constituents, the decision they made to put some ancient Senate tradition ahead of the priorities that they ran on and that they stand for was wrong economically, morally, and politically, he said. Birol was referring to the fact that Senate Democrats removed the $15 minimum wage provision from their version of the COVID-19 relief bill after the White House made clear that Vice President Kamala Harris would not be willing to exercise her authority to override the widely condemned advisory opinion of the Senate parliamentarian, an unelected official with zero constitutional authority, that deemed the proposed pay hike a violation of budget reconciliation rules. Sanders' attempt to use the amendment process to add a federal minimum wage increase to the coronavirus relief legislation came in the wake of that decision. It is despicable and unacceptable, said Representative Jamal Bowman, and he added that there is not unanimous support among Democrats in Congress for a $15 minimum wage. There is no excuse, Pirrell said. Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Senator John Tester, Senator Joe Manchin, Senator Chris Kunz, Senator Gene Shaheen, Senator Tom Carper, and Maggie Hassan, both failed their people and their party. Neither those voting next year nor those reading the history of the next generation will appreciate those senators who could have changed the course of history, but chose not to. Undeterred, Sanders said recently that if any senator believes this is the last time they will cast a vote on whether or not to give a raise to 32 million Americans, they're sorely mistaken. We're going to keep bringing it up, and we're going to get it done because it is what the Americans demand and need. Joining the Sanders was Representative Pramila Jayapal, who tweeted that she will never stop fighting to make the minimum wage a living wage. It's long overdue that we give 32 million workers a raise and lift a million people out of poverty, Jayapal added.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and condolences to all on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Musa al-Kazem, peace be upon him, the seventh infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We now present you a short but sweet statement from Imam Musa al-Kazem, peace be upon him. The best kind of almsgiving is to help the weak.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
welcome to the light. Japan is famous for its vending machines, but the technology is now being used to improve public access to coronavirus test kits. A group of medical experts in a clinic has set up 7 vending machines across the capital, Tokyo, to sell their test kits. Customers take the PCR test and then mail off their saliva sample for processing. Each machine holds 60 kits. The idea was met with great enthusiasm from people. It helps them to avoid crowded clinics.
Without PCR tests, we can't make a diagnosis. Early diagnosis and early treatment is a basic idea for all diseases. But unfortunately, there is no treatment for COVID-19. So I strongly felt that we had to do early diagnosis and early isolation.
Experts believe the number of PCR tests conducted in Japan is extremely low. They hope that the initiative can increase the figure. The machines sell the kits at around $40 each.
Teams of racing dog enthusiasts have converged on the Russian city of Irkutsk to participate in a 150-kilometer marathon on ice. The contest was held on the icy surface of the famous Baikal Lake. The racers, who started off at 5 p.m., had to put up tents and use warm equipment to withstand temperatures as low as minus 12 degrees Celsius to spend the night. Participants are free to choose their tactics throughout the race.
What's good about this race is its straightforward format. Now the racers start off and we will stop the clock when they arrive. Where they sleep and eat and how they cover the distance is a matter of their personal strategy and tactics. This is a contest for the real athletes.
The dogs can help their owners find the right direction in case they are lost on the frosty path. They can seek help from other rivals too. The Baikal race is an annual event that was held for the 7th consecutive time this year.
Get ready for a big dose of cuteness. In India, dozens of little turtles have been released into sea. Forest officials in a southern Indian town let loose 131 endangered turtle hatchlings. They had kept the eggs for over 50 days until the day came to set them free. The environmentalists also plan to release 4 other cute turtles, which are still too shy to come out of their cozy eggs. Marine turtles have existed for more than 100 million years. The numbers have fallen in the past few years due to human activities. Moving on, NASA's Mars rover Dot Perseverance has successfully completed its first ever test drive on the red planet. The 6-wheeled rover traveled more than 6 meters in 33 minutes. NASA officials called the mission a huge milestone. They also released images showing the robot's wheel tracks on the surface of the planet and surrounding landscape. NASA engineers say they are now preparing for the first flight of a helicopter drone carried by the rover. Perseverance was launched last summer and landed on Mars earlier in February. Its main goal is to search for traces of ancient microbial life there. It is going to collect soil and rock samples from the Martian surface and send them back to the Earth in the next decade for analysis.
An Australian conservation group says it will build the world's first ever platypus refuge facility.
We're also going to build a platypus refuge, one of its kinds around the world. This refuge will be able to take up to 6 to 5 platypuses in a time of crisis. Right now there is so much to learn about the platypus, and we know so little. These facilities will be critical in building our knowledge so that we don't let this iconic creature slip off the earth.
Platypuses are among Australia's most unique and elusive animals. They're normally found across the country's eastern seaboard. The strange-looking creatures are the only remaining representatives of their family. They spend most of their lifetime underwater and alone. Australian authorities say the planned refuge facility can give them more information about the animal's preferred environment and breeding. Many habits of the platypuses have remained a mystery to researchers. A family therapist in the U.S. state of California has come up with a brilliant idea to calm her angry clients, and that's a rage room. Yashika offers stressed people a smash session. The participants are allowed to destroy different items with a hammer, golf club, or baseball bat. They are required to wear protective gloves and face shields. During the session, the therapist also tries to teach the participants different ways to manage their stress in a healthy way.
So it's actually the first rage room to incorporate a therapeutic aspect. So when people come in, they're not just coming in to break stuff. They're really coming in to get the tools and techniques they need to manage stress and health in a healthy manner and a healthy way.
Yashika hopes the smash therapy will be largely accepted as a productive way to release tension. The idea was originally a simple stress reliever for everyday problems, but it was warmly received after everything started shutting down due to the pandemic. Hungry for music? You can now order a concert instead of a pizza if you live in the German city of Frankfurt. Members of Frankfurt's Philharmonic Orchestra have decided to help music lovers now that concert halls are closed due to the pandemic. They offer short personal concerts at people's staircases for free. Instead, Frankfurt residents can donate money to the musicians, who say the main goal is to revive the creative industry.
We play miniature concerts in people's homes of about 10 minutes, and we deliver along a route in our neighborhood so that people can enjoy some live music. For us, it's just beautiful being able to play for people again. What's great and absurd about this concept at the same time is that we play in order to keep a distance. Yet we are so much closer than in a conventional concert hall, and that makes it so wonderful for us.
Those who ordered the concerts have called their experience delightful. They say the music delivery service has filled the void of the closure of theaters and music halls. The personal concerts can be booked online, performers observe health protocols and social distancing too. A rare black rhino calf becomes an internet celebrity as a video of her first wobbly steps has gone viral. The cute baby was born last week at Adubo Zoo in New South Wales, Australia. The newborn, yet to be named, has three siblings. Her mother is 18 years old and her father passed away a few months ago. Zookeepers watched the calf and her mother through cameras in order to create a proper atmosphere for them to make bond. The species is critically endangered because of poaching and habitat loss. Sophisticated scanning technology is revealing new secrets about Littlefoot. That's a well-preserved fossil of an early human forerunner dating back to nearly 3.7 million years ago.
Now, the importance of it is not only that it is the only complete skull of an Australopithecus from anywhere, but it is the only one with a complete skeleton as well. Furthermore, it is the oldest Australopithecus in southern Africa, dating to 3.67 million years ago. So it tells us a lot about our early ancestry. Now, we're not saying that Littlefoot represents a direct ancestor to modern humans, but certainly a relative, certainly a very close relative of our ancestors.
The fossil was found in South Africa in the 1990s. It's now being studied at a particle accelerator facility in Oxfordshire, Britain. The facility allows scientists to produce X-ray images of the fossil with extreme detail. They say the result has been fascinating.
The bone microstructure look amazing because we can really see the different tissues, the proportions, the thickness, and also the like the size of the different canals. So all of this make, I think for me, make Littlefoot more like a living person.
So far, scientists have found that Littlefoot stood on her feet. They know she had gorilla-like features such as powerful hands, which enabled her to climb trees. But she also had different traits compared to the human species believed to have first appeared 300,000 years ago. A Nigerian artist has become famous for his skills in creating art from coconut shells. Nathaniel Hodonu uses the shells to make stunning artworks in different forms, including portraits and sculptures, as well as home accessories. He collects shells from local oil factories, which throw them away as waste. He began his work in 2006 after his art teacher gave him two coconuts as a present. Hodonu now teaches art lovers creative ways to transform waste coconut shells into beautiful handicraft.
Tourism in Oman took a nosedive during the COVID-19 pandemic, sadly, much like many places in the world. But one village managed to turn its fortunes around by transforming some ancient homes in into hotels and touristic attractions. Nestled in the high mountains of Oman, the village of Misfat al-Ibrahim offers some of the most beautiful and serene natural areas for trail running and rock climbing. Now the village has repurposed ancient mud brick homes into boutique hotels. The beige-coloured homes with walls of handmade mud brick are elegant and simple, and the interior spaces are furnished with traditional wood and textiles.
Misfat al-Ibrahim attracts many tourists, so people and project owners in the village have planned on expanding touristic projects. You'll find heritage hotels, popular cafes and restaurants. We, as a company, decided to provide various adventure-related activities too.
The centuries-old homes were renovated for safety and comfort to combine old Omani life with modern amenities. The village is near what is called Oman's Grand Canyon and has somewhere around 800 residents. Many tourists have visited the area because of the heritage hotels and environmental components in the ancient village. These inns have attracted many tourists to the area despite the COVID-19 pandemic.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us and bye-bye.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Aqil Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatihul Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. I remember there's a story of regularly mentioned where, you know, even if you have a cup of water, and probably very simple for you to think that what's the value of this water if I drink a little bit of it and throw the rest away. But that accumulates, and that could be in the eyes of some, and the story that I'm mentioning is the likes of Imam Khomeini, where he used to have a cup of water in the night time. He used to put the water next to his bedside table, and he used to cover the water with a piece of paper so that he will be able to continue to drink it throughout the night or when he wakes up in the morning, to avoid wasting of something as simple as a cup of water. And therefore, we need to always remember that, you know, there's that common etiquette that must be observed when it does come to something like something as simple as appreciating water and drinking of water. Now, let me read through some of the important points that Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli is mentioning here as far as drinking of water. The first thing that he does mention is that the most exceptional way of you being able to drink water is with your own hand. And he mentions a hadith where it says that once you wash your hand, drink from your hand. And this is the hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, where he says, أَغْسِلُوا أَيْدِيَكُمْ ثُمَّ شْرُبُوا فِيهَا. Wash your hands, and then drink from it. فَلَيْسَ مِنْ إِنَاءٍ أَطْيَبَ مِنَ الْيَدِ. And there is nothing, there's no kind of container, there's no kind of vessel, there's no kind of container that is nicer than drinking from your own hand. Then there is the common kind of sunnah of saying Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim or saying Bismillah, which we've already mentioned when it comes to food, and when you finish you say Alhamdulillah. We know that sometimes, you know, a person might be drinking water in a particular way, and we've mentioned before that the Islamic adab, the Islamic etiquette of drinking water is not for you to gulp it, but for you to be sucking the water. And let me show you. So you wouldn't be drinking the water like this. So there's a distance between you and, for example, the cup. You would be drinking the water like that. Now the hadith says, and I'm going to read it as well, is that you should be drinking it slowly, slowly. Now the hadith says that don't drink water like an animal. Naha Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he said, drink, don't drink like animals. Drink from your hand, because it is the best container for water. It's the best cup, if we could say, for drinking.
Ayatollah Javadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Another hadith from the Holy Prophet, إِنَّ الَّذِي يَأْكُلُ أَوْ يَشْرَبْ فِي آنِيَةِ الْفِضَّةِ. So, you know that it is haram to buy or sell or have containers or utensils made of silver or gold. And it is also forbidden for one to drink or eat from them, whether it be a spoon, whether it be a cup, whether it be a bowl, any kind of utensil, eating or drinking utensil. In Islam, is haram to have, let alone to drink or eat from. And if one was to do so, if one was to eat or drink from an min fi aniyati al-fiddati wal-dhahabi, innama yujarjiru fi batnihi nara jahannam. In reality, what they are doing is they are bringing forward, or they are consuming the fire of jahannam. So we understand that there are sunnahs when it comes to eating and drinking, and there are also, of course, the wajib kind of things or the haram kind of things that we need to avoid. Always make sure that you are drinking with your right hand, because the left hand is for other things. Now, here, hadith from Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Of course, we know that one of the makruh things is to eat or drink from a broken utensil. To drink from a broken cup is makruh. One hadith says, you should not drink from that cracked side. Another hadith says you should throw the utensil away altogether because it brings about faqr and poverty. Imam al-Kadhim, salamullahi alayhi, he was asked about a utensil, and he said, "Hadduhu an la tashrab min mawdi'i kasrin in kana bihi." You shouldn't drink from the place that there's a crack in it. We will continue on in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahireen.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children's cries.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov was spot on when he said at the United Nations Human Rights Council meeting on 24th of February, the pandemic has exacerbated old problems such as racism and xenophobia, as well as discrimination against national and religious minorities. Mass protests in the United States and Europe have exposed these countries' continuing systemic inequalities, whilst highlighting the risks of condoning extremist ideologies. We're prepared for you an article written by former Indian diplomat M.K. Badrakumar under the heading, U.S. Exceptionalism Surges Again, Will It Fly? The article has been taken from the AsiaTimes.com website. Please stay with us for more of M.K. Badrakumar's article. In recent statement marking the return of the United States to the United Nations Human Rights Council, the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, claimed that President Joe Biden's administration is placing democracy and human rights at the center of American foreign policy. But the cat is out of the bag. The U.S. is in relative decline, and there is a resource crunch. There is an absence of a positive vision for humanity as the country struggles with its own demons. The dramatic events in American society and politics in recent past badly exposed the country as a sham democracy with an abominable record of racism and appalling inequality, where the top 0.1% of the population hold roughly the same share of the country's wealth as the bottom 90% of the population. But the resurrection of American exceptionalism will have no takers, and the United States, lacking the capacity and the moral authority to advance a unifying agenda in the international arena, is assembling a toolkit for its diplomacy with geopolitical objectives. The potential of the United Nations Human Rights Council ought to be directed at the raging COVID-19 pandemic, which has undermined the social and economic foundations of states. The most fundamental human right, the right to life, has been threatened, with the world economic downturn causing a big rise in unemployment and aggravating social insecurity. The development gaps between nations and regions are widening. Yet the United States is in a category of itself, even among the so-called rich countries of the world. COVID-19 deaths per million inhabitants have gone through the roof in the United States in comparison with its own allies. The appalling reality is that in the United States, the death toll from the epidemic has now gone over 500,000. Ironically, per capita COVID-19 deaths in some of the countries that Anthony Blinken berates for deficit in democracy and human rights put the U.S. to shame, including in Syria, Venezuela, Cuba, and Sri Lanka, and of course, China. But for the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, such a horrific level of deaths among his countrymen isn't a human rights issue. Not a single state functionary in the United States has been held responsible for such a tragedy of unspeakable proportions. Suffice it to say, the U.S. is bringing disrepute and shame to the whole Western world by leading them into such a cynical game. Strutting around as champions of human rights when, according to a recent estimate, more than half of all vaccines against COVID-19 have been reserved for 1/7 of the world's population. Isn't that a matter of human rights? The United Kingdom alone has reportedly secured enough vaccines to give each of its citizens 5 doses. If orders are met, the European Union and the United States could inoculate their populations 3 times over, whilst Canada would have enough to do so 9 times over. It is a disaster, Mr. Blinken. At the same time, competition for diminishing vaccine supplies may lead to price hikes and further friction. Acrimony has erupted among the European Union, the United Kingdom, and AstraZeneca over a shortfall in vaccine production. Meanwhile, in any situation where supplies are scarce and demand is rising, it is the poorer countries that will suffer most. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov was spot on when he said at the United Nations Human Rights Council meeting on 24th of February, "The pandemic has exacerbated old problems such as racism and xenophobia, as well as discrimination against national and religious minorities. Mass protests in the United States and in Europe have exposed these countries' continuing systemic inequalities, whilst highlighting the risks of condoning extremist ideologies. It is utter moral bankruptcy that the United States and its rich allies in the Western world walk into the United Nations Human Rights Council and start pontificating about human rights and pursue coercive approaches and unlawful methods of intimidation and pressure with narrow and self-serving geopolitical goals. Again, aren't the non-transparent policies of social networking platforms a matter of human rights too? The US, in particular, undertook commitments to ensure freedom of access to information for all citizens, but is now hiding behind corporate policies to avoid delivering on these commitments. As for the social networking platforms, they have begun brazenly to manipulate public opinion in the developing countries by banning or censoring user content at their own discretion. Now they are